Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 14th of February 2024. From the news section. Abortion clinic buffer zones will end intimidation and harassment. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Corey. The MSP leading moves to pass legislation to establish buffer zones around abortion clinics hopes this will be the last year women will be subject to intimidation and harassment by protesters outside medical facilities. Green Health spokesperson Gillian McKay condemned such demonstrations as being utterly shameful. The MSP spoke out as pro-life group 40 Days of Life started a 40-day-long period of demonstrations outside clinics where women can terminate pregnancies. Its campaign is due to run until March 24th, but Ms. McKay said, "These protests are utterly shameful. Nobody should have to face down a sea of graphic placards and banners in order to get to a hospital. It is targeted intimidation and harassment, and it is being done in order to stop people from accessing the healthcare they are entitled to." It underlines exactly why buffer zones are so critical. The Green MSP has introduced a members' bill at Holyrood, which, if passed, would outlaw demonstrations at clinics. The Abortion Services Safe Access Zones Scotland Bill proposes that pro-life campaigners be fined if they stage a protest within 200 metres of such a facility, with unlimited fines for serious breaches. The legislation, which is being supported by the Scottish Government, was brought forward in response to complaints from women who face protests when attending the clinics. MSPs on Holyrood's Health Committee will start hearing evidence on the proposals later this month. Ms. McKay said, "I hope that all MSPs support my bill and that we can make this the year that we stop the protests for good. I have spoken to so many service users and hospital staff who have told me about their experiences and the awful impact these protests have had on them. My heart and solidarity goes out to everyone who has had to endure them. Abortion rights are human rights. They are non-negotiable. I don't want this to be a country where people are afraid to access healthcare. I hope 2024 can be the year that changes." That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Jodie Harrison. And it was read by me, Corey. The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 14th of February 2024. From the news section. Shetland Coast Guard Emergency Channel broadcast Radio 4 for 12 hours. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Corey. A Coast Guard emergency radio channel was blocked for 12 hours by a sailor off the coast of Shetland listening to BBC Radio 4 non-stop. Shetland Coast Guard had to contact the BBC for help after a ship somewhere near the islands accidentally broadcast the station on the Maritime Emergency Channel. Channel 4 had to send out a message telling all ships in the area to check their radio equipment. It is thought the channel had been left open by someone leaving the broadcast switched on. The distress and safety frequency, known as the VHF Channel 16, experienced intermittent interference on February 5th as the sailor listened to episodes of The Archers, Women's Hour, and Just a Minute. The Radio 4 message said, "This is an important safety-related message on behalf of His Majesty's Coast Guard. This radio programme is being transmitted over VHF Channel 16 by a vessel with an open mic. This is blocking all distress, urgency and safety broadcasts. All vessels in the vicinity of South East Shetland are requested to check their radios and ensure that the microphone transmit button is not being inadvertently held open." Laura Kay, the team leader of Shetland Coast Guard, told Radio 4's Broadcasting House programme how the incident unfolded. She said, "The day watch had Radio 4 coming through the transmission. It was transmitting for about 12 hours at various levels of clarity. In our policy, there is actually a bit that says, if you can hear a radio station, you can contact them and ask them to broadcast a safety message. We have had incidents before where there has been a fault with the equipment. If you spilled something on the handset, the button could stick, or it's just not been properly set down." The team leader added that there had been no incidents during the period the channel was blocked. The Coast Guard said VHF Channel 16 must be kept clear for distress and urgency traffic only, and urged mariners to regularly check their radio equipment to ensure that it is in good condition to avoid accidental transmission. That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Jodie Harrison, and it was read by me, Corey.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 4th of April, from the sports section. Rory McIlroy gets pre-masters lesson from Tiger Woods' former coach. Article written by Martin McMillan. Rory McIlroy believes his lesson with Tiger Woods' former coach Butch Harmon was really worthwhile as he prepares to make his 10th attempt to complete a career Grand Slam. McIlroy needs to win the Masters to join Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan, Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus and Woods as the only players to have won all four major championships. The world number two started the year well with victory in the Dubai Desert Classic in January, but his form on the PGA Tour has been underwhelming ahead of this week's Valero Texas Open. McIlroy revealed on the I Can Fly podcast with PGA Tour professional Morgan Hoffman that he had recently visited Harmon in Las Vegas and expanded on the visit in his pre-tournament press conference in San Antonio. "I've done this a number of times in my career," McIlroy said. "I met Butch when I was 14 years old, so we've always had a good relationship. If there's one guy I want to go to get a second opinion from, it's him. I just think after the Players' Championship and just sort of struggling through that Florida swing, and with some of the misses I was having with my irons, I just thought to myself, I'm obviously missing something here, and I just would love to go and get a second opinion and have him take a look, a second set of eyes. The one thing with Butch is you go spend time with him and you're always going to feel better about yourself at the end of it, whether you're hitting it better or not. He's sort of half golf coach, half psychologist in a way. It's fun to go out there. I went and spent probably 4 hours with him in Vegas. He said a couple of things to me that resonated. It's the same stuff I've been trying to do with my coach Michael Bannon, but he just said it in a different way, and that maybe hit home with me a little bit more. It was a really worthwhile trip, and I feel like I've done some good work after that. As I said, this is a good week to see where that work has gotten me." Speaking before the Players' Championship last month, where he carded an opening 65 before fading to tie for 19th, McIlroy revealed the reasons behind his current struggles. "I have this amazing feeling with my woods at the minute, but when I try to recreate that feeling with the irons, it starts left and goes further left. McElroy said, I have a swing thought for my woods and I need a different swing thought for my irons, and that's what I've been working on the last couple of days. I feel like every other part of my game is in great shape. And that article was written by Martin McMillan and read by me, Ian McKenna. From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 4th of April, from the Arts and Entertainment section, hate crimes. Mary Beard says gender debates are not new. This article is taken from the Herald magazine, the best of our weekly guide to everything happening in Scotland. Before Mary Beard brings her Roman Emperor documentary to the BBC, she explains why the rulers are important today. They were cruel Roman emperors, stupid ones, and some that were just very good at PR. For example, Marcus Aurelius was known as the philosophising ruler who oversaw a period of peace, but his reign was heavily punctuated by bloody imperial expansion and persecuting Christians. Dame Mary Beard peels back the layers of Roman propaganda to show how power was wielded, and, rather than chronicling events, she takes us inside the palace where smutty graffiti was written by slaves, and Augustus, Nero, Hadrian, or Marcus Aurelius, and lesser-known oddballs like Domitian and Elagabalus terrified their dining guests. The historian classicist, 69, is concerned with what stories, such as short-lived Elagabalus never wearing the same pair of shoes twice, tells us about his subjects, and how the mundane acts like paperwork took up much of an emperor's time. She will be appearing in Glasgow in July to discuss her work at the City Halls. Dame Mary says the name of recognition of figures like Nero and Julius Caesar means we've got a pretty kind of clear idea about the lurid excesses of and cruelty of Roman imperial power. And by trying to get behind the mask, viewers can visit the palaces at the Palatine Hill, where we can more accurately find out how they ate, slept and plotted. There are, of course, tales of luxurious and stupid dining, where the emperor and his subjects would sometimes sit in the middle of the sea and have their food floated down to them in little boats, in the TV production, but she cautions that many written accounts are not based on reality and the tales are a bit similar to celebrity gossip. There are all these stories about Roman emperors, the Emperor Domitian skewering five slices with his pen, or Caligula deciding he would make his horse a consul, a magistrate. Dame Mary says, I think the brutal truth is we don't know if they're true. Much like the inner lives of today's movie stars and royalty, she said they are vehicles for historians to understand how we projected our own questions and anxieties and aspirations onto them. Dame Mary says, I see both now in celebrity terms and in the ancient world, tons of people thinking, what would I do if I was the most powerful person in the world? If I could sleep with anybody, who would it be? And if I had more money and more wealth than anybody else, what would I eat? How would I dine? What would my dinner party look like? And, to some extent, I think that in all of us, what you're seeing is people's attempts to imagine what it's like. Dame Mary says eccentric Elagabalus reputation, who recently hit the headlines for being reclassified as an LGBT figure by a Hertfordshire museum, because he was the focus of unverified Roman tale that he asked doctors to make him a woman, reminds us that some of our debates about gender and gender division are not new. For 2,000 years, people have wondered about whether division lies between men and women, how that division can be crossed, and I think, for me, whether it's true or not, it's as a reminder that we're not the first people to have grappled with these issues, she adds. It does look as if Elagabalus was bothered with his pronouns. He also upturned versions of gender in all kinds of other ways. He is supposed to have tried to convene a female senate. In Roman times that was utterly shocking. It was putting women in the public sphere, so Elagabalus is considered pushing, in the stories, gender boundaries. If we cannot be sure of contemporary accounts, what would Dame Mary like to journey back and see? She said she would like to visit a Roman bathhouse to get beyond the image of it being all blokes taking their clothes off, admiring each other and rubbing down and all that kind of stuff, to what was really going on in these private areas. Dame Mary has previously fronted the BBC documentaries Caligula with Mary Beard in 2013 and Meet the Romans with Mary Beard in 2012 and is inspired by her new one-hour documentary by her non-fiction title Emperor of Rome, Ruling the Ancient Roman World, which received rave reviews last year for the programme. One thing she most enjoyed was going to the main palace in Rome and seeing how scary it could be with its blind corners and you can't see who's coming around, which must have frightened visitors. Part of what the programme tries to do is to say it was terrifying for the Emperor too, and in the middle of this great sort of panoply of power, there was an ordinary guy who was trying to rule the Roman world and was, in some ways, a prisoner of his own palace, she says. You know, he was the victim. He was surrounded by people who would never tell him the truth. They don't really tell him what he wanted to hear. She notes the example of Domitian, who said to have the walls of his palace lined with shiny stones so he could tell what was coming around the corner, as emperors often got assassinated in their beds or poisoned at the dinner table, and rarely died in public. Dame Mary adds, I'm trying to create a world in which the emperor is sort of a victim of all this as well. It's hard to feel sorry for them, but I do a little bit. She is quick to advise caution by drawing exact parallels between ex-US President Donald Trump and Julius Caesar, who both promised to return to a glorious past, but says dictators and autocrats are also imprisoned by their own power. When it comes to the end of their power, they will end up in a seedy place, being put to death, and comforted or whatever by very few friends. It's still the pattern of what happens to an autocrat, adds Dame Mary. She also says, much like modern leaders who receive information through advisors, Roman autocrats would have known little about their own empires. Dame Mary says, how do people at the centre of power find someone who's going to tell them the truth? And how do they find out what's going on? You know, when people are actually not showing or keeping the truth from them. Meet the Roman Emperor with Mary Beard will air on BBC Two and iPlayer at 9 p.m. on Monday, April the 8th. She is appearing in Glasgow City Halls on July the 9th at 7:30 p.m. in An Evening with Mary Beard. See www.glasgowlife.org.uk. That's www.glasgowlife.org.uk. And that article was taken from the Herald magazine. From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 4th of April, from the Arts and Entertainment section, Johnny Marr, Glasgow Barrowland Review, former Smith has upper hand, report by Gabriel Mackay. It's nice to be back in one of the best places in the world, Johnny Marr tells the Barrowland crowd, to the obligatory cheer. Usually I just pander to the audience, but in this case it's actually true. The former Smiths guitarist is celebrating 10 years of his solo career with his Spirit Power Tour, the album of the same name having gone top 10, and the sense is very much of his having gained the upper hand over his erstwhile bandmate, you know the one. While Morrissey has spent the last couple of decades expressing support for the likes of Anne-Marie Waters, Tommy Robinson, and declaring, ultimately everyone prefers their own race, Marr's intricate, distinctive guitar has featured on albums by the likes of Blondie and Noel Gallagher, and on the James Bond soundtrack. He certainly seems like a man on top of the world, as he belies his 60 years with an exuberant entrance before launching into solo track Sensory Street. It's a pulsating opening, but, of course, the majority of the crowd are here for some Smiths. Marr obliges on track 2, a stomping panic bringing an early chant along for its famous Hang the DJ coda. But solo efforts such as Generate, don't seem out of place and are, almost, as well received. Jack's just going to make a small technical adjustment, the crowd is told before this charming man. And when a small delay prompts a F**k, Jack, from the crowd, the former Smith responds with a well-timed, exactly. If there's a dip in proceedings, it comes immediately after, with a more reflective number from Marr's most recent album, but, Of course, he can simply reach for please, please, please let me get what I want to ensure everyone is immediately back on side. There's an earring for a number of songs from his other former band, Electronic, one of which, Get the Message, could very well have sparked a mosh pit if most of the audience wasn't a little past the age for such shenanigans. Watching one of the nation's finest guitarists at work is never going to be anything other than a pleasure. Amar and his band bring a beefed up live sound to those ubiquitous Smith songs. That spirit is exemplified in the decision to throw in a cover of Iggy Pop's The Passenger before the biggest cheer of the night for There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. Perhaps the biggest compliment to Amar and Co is that you wouldn't want to hear these songs played by anyone else, including You Know Who. And that article was by Gabriel Mackay.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024, from the news section. Cross-party MSPs to probe Scotland's international aid. This article is written by Neil Pooran. A cross-party group of MSPs has launched an investigation into the Scottish Government's international aid funds, saying there is a lack of transparency. The cross-party group on international development says concerns have been raised from organisations in the sector around how funds are allocated and why. They point out that the government's regular report on contributions to international development has not been published since 2019. The government has a number of funding streams within its External Affairs Directorate, including development programmes for Malawi, Rwanda and Zambia. It also has a Climate Justice Fund and a Humanitarian Emergency Fund. The MSPs will undertake desk-based research before publishing recommendations for a more transparent approach. On the group are three SNP, two Labour, two Conservative and one Green MSPs. The group's chairwoman, Labour's Sarah Boyack, said, "We know the great benefits that international aid can bring to communities in need. However, for too long there has not been transparency on how the Scottish Government's aid programmes have been delivered. This inquiry aims to take a constructive approach to bring clarity into the Scottish Government's aid programme. If Scotland is going to make a substantial impact with its international aid, it is vital that the processes for awarding this aid are suitably transparent. I look forward to engaging with stakeholders and others to carry out this inquiry. Our aim will always be to ensure that Scotland is world-leading in international aid, but it is critical that humanitarian support is sent to the right places and for the right reasons." A Scottish Government spokesman said, "All overseas development assistance provided by the Scottish Government is guided by a rigorous process to ensure complete transparency and accountability, focused on areas of need where Scotland's aid can make an impact. A report on all Scottish Government overseas development spend for 2021-23 will be published later this month. As the CPG is aware, the Scottish Government has engaged closely with representatives from our partner countries of Malawi, Rwanda and Zambia in the design of our new Climate Justice, Inclusive Education and Support for Women and Girls programmes, which have been led by their priorities. While our overseas aid primarily supports projects in partner countries, we have supported humanitarian crises across tens of contexts, including Ukraine, Gaza, Pakistan, Turkey and Syria in recent years. Our primary concern is the swift delivery of aid where it is needed most, in line with our commitment to be a good and compassionate global citizen. We would be happy to further discuss this work with the CPG." That article was written by Neil Pooran. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024, from the news section. Deltic, backed by Shell and Dana, as it targets Big Prospect. This article is written by Mark Williamson. A North Sea-focused exploration specialist has provided evidence that oil and gas firms still see lots to go for in the area, amid uncertain times in the industry. Deltic Energy said it expects to drill a well on a big gas prospect in the coming months after winning backing from UK and overseas heavyweights for its plans. The company confirmed that it had completed a deal to sell a 25% stake in the Selene prospect to Korea National Oil Corporation, which was agreed in February. Selene is one of the biggest undrilled prospects in an area in which firms have found lots of gas over the years. It is estimated to contain more than 50 million barrels of oil equivalent. Completion of the deal should pave the way to Deltic starting drilling work on Selene in July, with KNOC and with the mighty Shell. Deltic sold a 50% stake in Selene to Shell in 2019. Shell's decision to go ahead with drilling on Selene suggests that giants still see potential to make commercially viable finds in the North Sea, in the wake of a series of controversial tax changes. Industry leaders have highlighted the uncertainty that firms have faced following the introduction of the windfall tax in May 2022, amid the surge in oil and gas prices fueled by Russia's war on Ukraine. The rate of the levy was increased in November of that year. The month after Deltic agreed the terms of the Selene deal with KNOC, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt extended the term of the windfall tax by a year to 2029 in his spring budget. Firms can benefit from generous investment allowances that were introduced alongside the windfall tax. Shell may be prepared to take a chance on Selene because a previous bet it made with Deltic appeared to pay off handsomely. When it cut the Selene deal with Deltic, Shell also bought a stake in the Pensacola prospect in the North Sea from the company. The firms drilled a well on Pensacola last summer, which Deltic chief executive Graham Swindles said delivered transformational results for the firm. Well data indicates that Pensacola contains close to double our original estimate, representing one of the most significant discoveries in the North Sea in many years, said the Glasgow University graduate in July. With a market capitalisation of around £35 million, Deltic remains a relative minnow in the industry. Its valuation could increase significantly if the Selene well hits the mark. That article was written by Mark Williamson. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024, from the news section. Humza Yousaf warns PM UK risks being complicit in killing. This article is written by Craig Williams. Humza Yousaf has told the Prime Minister the UK risks being complicit in the killing of innocent civilians if it carries on selling arms to Israel. Amid the ongoing conflict, the First Minister wrote to Rishi Sunak to again make the case for an immediate end to arms sales to Israel from the United Kingdom. The SNP leader told the Prime Minister, "The civilian death toll is intolerable, as is the killing of humanitarian aid workers who deliver vital aid to Palestinians facing starvation and violence at the hands of this Israeli government. By not stopping arms sales to Israel, the UK is in danger of being complicit in the killing of innocent civilians." The SNP is already calling for MPs to return to the House of Commons early from their Easter break to debate and vote on ending arms sales to Israel. Stephen Flynn, the SNP's Westminster leader, said that if the UK government are unwilling to act, then Parliament should force them to do so. Meanwhile, Mr. Yousaf, whose parents-in-law were trapped in Gaza for several weeks last year after the conflict erupted, said that Israel's actions have long since gone beyond a legitimate response. In his letter to Mr. Sunak, the First Minister said, "The UK government continue to allow British-based companies to arm Israel, despite the fact that Israel has killed children, women, aid workers and bombed hospitals, schools and refugee camps." The Prime Minister, however, has defended the UK's careful export licensing regime. Speaking to the Sun newspaper's Never Mind the Ballots show, Mr. Sunak said, "I think we've always had a very careful export licensing regime that we adhere to. There are a set of rules, regulations and procedures that we'll always follow." Mr. Sunak said he had been consistently clear to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu since the start of the conflict that while the UK would defend Israel's right to defend itself and its people against attacks from Hamas, they have to do that in accordance with international humanitarian law, protect civilian lives. He stressed the importance of getting more aid into Gaza, saying, "That's what we've consistently called for, and what we want to see actually is an immediate humanitarian pause to allow more aid in, and crucially, the hostages to be released, and that's what we'll continue to push for." That article was written by Craig Williams. This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 4th of April 2024, from the news section. Nicola Sturgeon may vote against assisted dying at Holyrood. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. Nicola Sturgeon has said she is deeply conflicted on the matter of assisted dying and may vote against new legislation moving through the Scottish Parliament. Liberal Democrat MSP Liam MacArthur is championing a bill that would allow terminally ill adults aged over 16 to receive assistance to die if ruled mentally fit to make the decision by two doctors. The former First Minister has voted against previous attempts to legalise assisted dying in Scotland, but said she had expected to be persuaded by the arguments this time round. However, writing in the Herald's sister paper, the Glasgow Times, Ms. Sturgeon said she is swaying against the proposed legislation. She said, "I have rarely been as conflicted on any issue as I am on this. On previous occasions, when the matter has come before Parliament, I have voted against. I have been determined this time to consider the issue afresh and to consider all the different arguments with an open mind." Liam is to be commended for the thorough and sensitive way in which he is giving Parliament the opportunity to do so. "I had expected this time, if I am being frank, to find myself swaying in favour of the legislation. I believe that we all deserve as much agency as possible over our own lives, and, in theory at least, I understand the argument that this must entail, in some circumstances, the right to decide when to end our lives." Last week it was confirmed that ministers are to be given a free vote on the new assisted dying bill, it has been confirmed. A meeting of the Scottish Cabinet discussed Mr. MacArthur's new bill, which was published on Thursday last week, and it was agreed that there would be a free vote on the issue. It has been widely expected that the Cabinet would be allowed to vote with their conscience and without party influence, but this was the first confirmation that this will be the case. Ms. Sturgeon does go on to say she has been deeply moved by the accounts of terminally ill people who wish to die at a time of their own choosing, and, in response, has tried to imagine what she might do if faced with the same situation. She adds, "Can any of us answer this question properly in the abstract before and until we find ourselves in the situation? And even if I wouldn't choose it, does that justify me voting against the right of others to do so? Despite my expectations, the more deeply I think about the different issues involved, the more I find myself veering away from a vote in favour, not towards it." The SNP MSP said she has concerns that the Assisted Dying for Terminally Ill Adults Scotland Bill may have the unintended consequence of putting pressure on those at the end of their life to choose assisted dying. Ms. Sturgeon goes on to urge constituents with strong views on the matter to contact her. Humza Yousaf, the First Minister, and Anas Sawar, the leader of the Scottish Labour, have both said in recent weeks they are against the passing of assisted dying legislation, as has Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader. That article was written by Katrina Stewart. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024, from the news section. ScotGov plan to eradicate hornet threatening honeybees. This article is written by Josh Carmichael. Scots are being urged to look out for a predator hornet from Asia that could pose a threat to the country's honeybee population. The Scottish Government is in the middle of a second 10-year plan to boost the health of honeybees, which are considered one of the world's most vital pollinators for wildflowers and gardens. Now the public are being warned the species could be put at further risk due to a non-native predatory hornet. The yellow-legged Asian hornets, Vespa volutina nigrithorax, are known to be aggressive predators of multiple species, including honeybees and other pollinators. The predator is native to northern India, China, the Indo-Chinese Peninsula, and the Indonesian archipelago. Scottish Agriculture Minister Jim Fairley has said they are working on a plan to eradicate the yellow-legged Asian hornet before it can settle in the UK. He said, "I am delighted to see the progress made by the Bee Health Improvement Partnership to help deliver our second 10-year Scottish Government honeybee health strategy. By developing a contingency plan to address any Asian hornet incursion in Scotland, we are well prepared to tackle and eradicate the insect before it has an opportunity to establish. We cannot underestimate the devastating impact this non-native predator has on honeybees and other insects, including important pollinators, and I urge people to be aware of what to look for and report any potential sightings." The plan to deal with the hornet has been included in the first annual report of the Bee Health Improvement Partnership, BHIP. There are also other threats to Scotland's honeybees, which have been highlighted in the report. A parasite called Varroa mites pose the biggest threat to honeybee colonies in Scotland, it says. The Varroa mite is known to feed on bee larvae and pupae, resulting in deformation of the wings and bodies of bees when they develop and emerge as adults. They also feed on adult bees. However, the report states that there's been positive steps taken towards neutralising the threat of the parasite. A map showing the spread of the parasite and highlighting areas where the mite has not been reported, such as the islands of Colonsay and Oronsay, which are a nature reserve for Apis mellifera, black bee, has been shared with beekeepers across the country to highlight where particular care is needed in order to prevent spread of the parasite into these areas. While the Scottish Government is keen to keep the public vigilant over the Asian hornet, there have been no confirmed sightings of the predator north of England so far. The furthest north it was spotted was in Yorkshire. How do I report any sightings? The free Asian Hornet Watch app has been launched and is free to download on iPhones and Androids. On the app, members of the public can report suspect sightings of the hornets to the Great British Non-Native Species Secretariat, NNSS, which has responsibility for helping to coordinate the approach to invasive non-native species in Great Britain. The Asian Hornet Contingency Plan will ensure that any incursion is dealt with swiftly by Scottish Government honeybee inspectors, who would confirm the sighting and then take steps to find, destroy, and remove nests. That article was written by Josh Carmichael.
This article is from the Herald on Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024. It is from the Voices section and the headline is How to Fix the UK's Broken Housing Sector. The author is Colin McLean. What can fix UK housing? There is little dispute on the problems or even the remedies. The argument is all about priorities and finance. It's hard to know where to start. So much seems to be failing, and for decades, that the solutions now seem unaffordable. And as a devolved matter, how effectively has Scotland used its powers? The challenge is in the complexity of housing and the tensions that brings between local and national government, public and private, ownership and rental. It is not simply about new house completions, but the balance between social housing, quality of build and diversity of design. The policy needs to be flexible to fit communities and tackle inequalities. Framing the problem too narrowly, as simply numbers and affordability, would miss the regional variations and risk unintended consequences. For example, some of the problem lies in the rented sector, particularly with limited security of tenure and risk of inadequate maintenance to avoid deterioration in quality. But freezing rents may discourage improvement and limit finance available for new social housing projects. A holistic, longer-term strategy is needed. Despite the devolved powers, not all the housing levers are directly under Scottish control. House builders are mainly national and private sector, a concentrated group dominated by a small number of London-listed UK-wide businesses. There are no signs that concentration is about to change, with the recent collapse of the unlisted Stuart Milne Group showing how important access to stock market capital is. In late February, the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, delivered the result of its year-long assessment of British house building and announced that it was investigating possible price sharing by the largest house builders. It noted that in recent years, Scotland had come closer than England and Wales to meeting its implied target delivery levels, albeit with varying levels of achievement by different local authorities. What the private sector can deliver is finance by issuing shares or borrowing. This is crucial at a time of constrained public finance. Financial institutions are increasingly willing to invest in rented accommodation, including social housing. From a low base, the UK supply of affordable rented accommodation by registered for-profit providers has trebled over the past decade. There are some Scottish success stories in this sector. But the overall impact from the increased financialisation of the housing market has been mixed, with buy-to-let investors now a bigger part of the market and adding to upward pressure on house prices. Over the past two decades, the UK has moved from a peak of 70% home ownership towards rented and is now comparable to France, though still behind Germany and Scandinavian countries. This suggests that a higher proportion of renting is not necessarily the wrong model, but a framework of control on rents and accommodation quality is needed. Today, the UK has one of the most liberalised private renting systems in Europe. Scotland has brought in regulation, but it is too early to assess the impact of that change on supply. April sees Scotland move on from its temporary rent caps and a pause on evictions, and some tenants may be hit by a jump in rents. Over the last 18 months of rental price controls, many landlords will have seen their costs rise. Some may put their properties on the market, lacking confidence in the future role of the rented sector. A period of disruption is likely. The CMA report assesses Scotland's all-tenure building targets at 20,000 homes per year, not disproportionate to UK achievements. While labour shortages are holding back current new building starts, overall delivery of affordable and social housing is consistent with the longer-term targets. But the new build numbers conceal a deterioration of existing stock. Some homes may be lost to RAAC, and many social landlords are struggling to bring older properties up to modern standards. There should be targets for net numbers and an ambition for the quality of Scotland's overall social housing stock. Energy efficiency is not the only issue in creating decent homes for all. We can expect more legislation. The CMA report recommended enhanced customer protection measures and robust enforcement for homeowners in new estates impacted by private management arrangements. There is need for a consumer code giving greater clarity to buyers on the cost of a new home. Issues with land banks and the planning process were also identified as adding barriers to competition and deterring smaller house builders. It is important to put UK housing in context. It is certainly in crisis, but some of our problems are shared by other developed economies, and much of the current debate on housing lacks international comparison. Despite UK house prices rising faster than most countries, in terms of housing affordability, it ranks mid-table internationally, worse than the US and Canada, but better than Germany, France and Italy. The statistics hide some particular problems in big cities, but do suggest that our problems are more to do with market balance and the impact on inequalities. The housing crisis does not only have financial impact. Rising housing costs can exacerbate social divisions and create tensions within communities. Low-income families are disproportionately hit, and social inequalities made worse. Reports have found that a growing number of households spend a disproportionate amount of their income on rent, often exceeding 30%. This financial strain often undermines health and overall well-being, and housing is a big part of the growing gap in wealth and opportunities between generations, undermining social cohesion and aspiration. The challenge is to find the right mix of ownership and rental. The balance will vary by location. Some rented accommodation is needed in the Scottish economy for job mobility, students and tourism. Regulation will develop over the next few years, and it will be important to monitor and adjust where unintended consequences emerge. There is also a case for building political consensus on long-term housing strategy. A vision is needed for a horizon long past the political cycle. That article was by Colin McLean, a director of SVM Asset Management.
The Herald on the 5th of April and the Arts and Ends section. Andrew O'Hagan's Caledonian Road takes aim at British hypocrisies by Rosemary Goring. Caledonia Road, Andrew O'Hagan, Faber and Faber, £20, review by Rosemary Goring. Caledonia Road, like the street after which it's named, feels both modern and old. Andrew O'Hagan's ambitious seventh novel could hardly be more different from his last. Mayfly is a simple, powerful story of boyhood friendship that lasts a lifetime. By contrast, Caledonia Road is complex and convoluted, managing to be completely contemporary, yet as full of characters, plot lines, and morality tales as a Victorian novel. Largely set in and around the road that runs from King's Cross to Islington, it is a dissection of as Trollope might have said the way we live now. In the 19th century, this thoroughfare was filled with institutions, among them the Royal Caledonian Asylum and Pendonville Prison. Its populace embraced the poor and destitute and the comfortably well off. Today is much the same, albeit with a multicultural and student population unimaginable in earlier times. O'Hagan students, drug dealers and rappers in their crowded quarters rub shoulders with middle-class enclaves, such as the Thornhill Square, home to its tortured central character, the art critic and writer Campbell Flynn. Across more than 600 pages, O'Hagan dons Dickens's mantle and burrows under the skin of the city to illuminate who and what makes it tick. In so doing, he exposes the sources of the corruption and rot that seem to infect government as perniciously as the rest of society. It's a sickness that, as he cleverly shows, lies within even those who believe themselves politically and ethically correct. Entering the lives of people whose existences are alien to each other, with Asian seamstresses in a sweat factory, youthful gang members and people traffickers at one end, and MPs, aristocracy, fashionistas, the intelligentsia, Westminster and Russian oligarchs at the other, O'Hagan employs broad satire to pull them together in an effervescent, if occasionally exhausting, portrait of our times. At the story's heart is Campbell Flynn, survivor of a blighted Glasgow childhood, as is his sister Moira, a Labour MP for Ayrshire. Moira is a common sense and decency. Campbell is Tinker Bell, an academic and media darling whose controversial ideas are catnip to those more interested in novelty than meaning. He believes he is a good man, but as the story unfolds and his connections to far from upright individuals emerge, he begins to question who he is, at which point his grip on reality begins to loosen. Those malign influences and contacts include his old university friend William Byer, from whom he has borrowed heavily to sustain his bourgeois lifestyle, unbeknownst to his imperturbable and long-suffering therapist wife, Elizabeth. Byer will soon be exposed as a pariah, but it is he who has perhaps the clearest perspective on Flynn. He looked at pictures, but the big picture and his part in it escapes him. When Milo Mangasha, one of Flynn's precocious students, befriends him, Flynn is flattered and intrigued, even though he can sense danger. The young man has edges, and they often glinted in the blade of his charm. As his research assistant, Milo introduces him to the dark web and the intricacies of Bitcoin. Here be echoes of research O'Hagan has previously done as a journalist. But soon the relationship, which is not sexual but nevertheless all-consuming, becomes a driving force in his life. Milo, meanwhile, is on a crusade. His involvement with Flynn is merely a means to an end, namely revenge upon the establishment and its utterly rotten core. Driven by the central idea that London has become the world capital of diseased finance, in a thrall to Russian money and power, and that we are a nation that turns a blind eye, Caledonian Road is simultaneously funny and savage, offering cameos of criminal London youths involved in gang rivalry. The ventriloquist O'Hagan captures their lingo convincingly, keen to demonstrate his mastery of every sphere of society. Chapters on people trafficking and drug distribution show the business to be so routine as to be almost suburban. Add these to the excesses of a Russian billionaire's debauched son, the breathtaking narcissism of the club scene and fashion world, or indeed the nasty little secrets held by a duke who happens to be Flynn's brother-in-law, and what you have is an exorbitating dissection of British society, inclusion of the cocooned middle classes and their lieges. Above all, however, it's the story of a talented man who learns how morally low he can sink. O'Hagan's prose sparkles with verve and conviction. There are passages of high humour, but because everyone will recognise how close to the shameful truth of today's inequalities and iniquities the novel comes, the overall tone is sombre. As the At times, the plot, which is as labyrinth as the London Underground, feels a little contrived. The plethora of names is bewildering, initially at least, although thankfully there is a list of characters, as there is for, say, War and Peace. Perhaps the most serious criticism is the hectic progression of events, in the sense of reading while on a roundabout that is whirling faster and faster until you feel you might topple off. It's a lot to take in. Yet this being O'Hagan, the writing is very good indeed. Flynn's daughter, his partner AJ, flitted in and out of everybody's life as if performance was conspiracy supported by old people and their nostalgic governments. Moira, back in a Scottish constituency, reflects, when people say darkness falls, they could be thinking of what happens in Ayrshire, when the dark drops out of the sky at tea time, the street lamps smartly blinking to life like they've arrived for work. Billed as a State of the Nation novel, Caledonian Road manages to meet its remit without too obviously showing the tick box list of issues it must necessarily address. In the purlieus of Westminster, Islington and the Hunt All Shires, this will make uncomfortable reading, but so it will for many of us. This is a novel about collusion and maintaining the status quo, no matter how venal. Who amongst us can confidently say we are not to some degree guilty of that? And that was by Rosemary Goring.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 8th of April, from the news section, exclusive, call for urgent action as purposeful activity hours plummet, by Andrew Learmonth. Overcrowding in Scotland's prisons has led to a significant drop in the number of purposeful activity hours being offered to inmates, new the figures have revealed. The Scottish Liberal Democrats have warned of a vicious cycle with prisoners reoffending because they have been deprived of education and training while inside that would help them rehabilitate. Liam MacArthur, the party's justice spokesman, has urged the SNP Green government to urgently publish a roadmap with milestones for increasing the provision of thorough care support and purposeful activity. The Scottish Prison Service, SPS, defines purposeful activity as any activity or constructive interaction which promotes citizenship, develops learning and employability skills, builds life skills and resilience, addresses well-being, and motivates personal engagement with both prison and community-based services. Figures uncovered by the Lib Dems through Freedom of Information show that between 2016-17 and August 2023, there has been a 25% drop in the number of purposeful activity hours in Scotland's largest prison, Barlinnie. In 2016, inmates in the Glasgow jail received 16 hours of purposeful activity. That dropped to 10 hours in 2020-21 before coming back up to 13 hours in 2022-23. At HMP Glenochle, there has been a 40% fall, while at HMP Grampian the difference is 32%. HMP Low Moss and Bishop Briggs has seen a 22% drop. Earlier this year, the head of SPS, Theresa Medhart, warned that inmates may have to be released early because of overcrowding. She told the BBC Disclosure programme, "If I have to say enough is enough, then it is because we are at tipping point. We cannot take any more. Prisons become very unsafe." The most recent statistics revealed by the Scottish Government said the prison population on the 5th of February 2024 was around 7,900. They have forecasted daily prison population to be between 7,350 and 8,450 in June 2024. One of the key problems for the Scottish system is the delayed replacement of Barlinnie Jail by HMP Glasgow, a project running around a decade late and £200 million over budget. Mr. MacArthur said, "Education and training are vital to a prisoner's rehabilitation journey. They develop learning and employability skills, increasing the chances of those leaving behind to be able to make positive contributions within their communities. To see evidence of a drop in the availability of these opportunities in certain parts of the estate, including in Scotland's largest prison, is, therefore, concerning. The majority of our prisons are now overcrowded, and that places real pressure on this prison service to deliver hours of purposeful activity. It also creates a vicious cycle, because without these hours, we can expect more people to re-offend and return to prison, putting communities at even greater risk, and placing ever more strain on a system that is already fit to burst. I would urge the Justice Secretary to urgently publish a roadmap with the milestones for increasing the provision of thorough care support and purposeful activity. More broadly, Scottish Liberal Democrats want to see government creating a properly funded justice system that will ensure we strike the right balance between punishing, supporting and crucially rehabilitating. Phil Fairley of the Prison Officers Association said the numbers were indicative of the wider impact overcrowding, combined with the complexity of the population mix inside Scotland's prisons, has as an impact on the outcomes of what staff are expected to deliver. He added, apart from the extra time being used in simply delivering the daily basics such as meals, medication, exercise, etc., our members have been drawn away from delivering the bit that makes the real difference to who we return back into our communities. We are not quite warehousing prisoners at the moment, but neither are we doing what we want and are trained to do in terms of tackling reoffending and preparing prisoners in the best way we can for release. That's not just a concern for us, it should concern society itself, because this is about reducing reoffending, reducing the numbers of victims of crime, and cutting down the numbers of those who return to our prisons. A Scottish Prison Service spokesperson said, we have a population that is not only rapidly increasing, but also far more complex, which continues to put significant pressure on our establishments, staff, and those in our care. Despite this, our staff work hard to offer the best possible regimes with access to programmes, work and activities, opportunities for progression, and meaningful rehabilitation, which will give those in our care the best possible chance of a successful return to the community. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, whilst the management and treatment of prisoners is an operational matter for the Scottish Prison Service, we recognise the importance of purposeful activities and through care support to enable rehabilitation and successful reintegration. Significant work is underway to respond to the higher prison population, and we are increasing the prison services resources by 10% to £436.6 million to enable them to continue to provide a safe and secure prison system. We are also continuing to invest in third sector and local authority through care services, while the Bail and Release from Custody Act 2023 will improve support for people leaving prison. And that article was an exclusive by Andrew Learmonth. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 8th of April, from the news section, Orkney Fall cliff climber says RNLI saved her life. Report by Josie Harrison. A climber has told of how a volunteer lifeboat crew saved her life after an abseiling trip went horribly wrong. In May 2022, Louise Houghton was visiting Orkney with friends after travelling up from Wigan. On the first day of the trip, Ms. Houghton and her friends had planned to visit the Old Man of Hoy, but, due to poor weather, they decided to go abseiling instead on Yesnaby Cliffs. When she jumped, the anchor that tethers the abseiler to the cliff edge failed, and Ms. Houghton fell onto the rocks below before plummeting into the sea. Her friends were then unable to pull her out. Ms. Houghton said, I remember falling and then being pulled out of the water by my friends. It all happened so quickly. After being pulled from the water, she added, I remember passers-by at the top of the cliff throwing down their jackets in an attempt to keep me warm, but I remember feeling hot. My vision began to go blurry, but I also felt a wave of adrenaline and started chatting to my friends. Royal National Lifeboat Institution, RNLI, volunteers, including Peter Mackay, soon arrived to treat her on the scene. Mr. Mackay, who has volunteered with Stromness RNLI for 11 years, said that although she was conscious at first, she appeared to be deteriorating quickly. He said, I had to make a decision as Louise was slipping in and out of consciousness. I made an initial assessment and requested another crew member came to help me put her on a stretcher and then transfer her to the all-weather lifeboat. Ms. Houghton was transferred over to the Stromness RNLI all-weather lifeboat named Violet, Dorothy and Kathleen and was then winched by a Coast Guard helicopter to be transferred to Balmore Hospital in Kirkwall. Mr. Mackay said, I had to stay on the rocks while they transferred Louise to the lifeboat, but when she arrived, the crew didn't think she was still with us. Fortunately, she regained consciousness and left with the Coast Guard helicopter. She definitely left in a better way than how we found her. Ms. Houghton, who would spend a total of 4 months in hospital following the accident, said, I broke my left arm, my back in multiple places, my pelvis and both my feet. I wasn't allowed to stand for 12 weeks until I could be awake. I needed the extra care and was placed on a rehab ward. My whole life changed in an instant. I went from being active and outdoorsy to not being able to stand for 12 weeks. It was both physically and mentally challenging, and I couldn't have done it without the support of my family and friends. I also can't forget about the amazing RNLI volunteers who came to my rescue. Without them, I wouldn't be here today. Ms. Houghton later met with the RNLI crew to express her gratitude. She said, It was amazing to meet the crew who rescued me that day and to say thank you to them. They chatted to me throughout the rescue and told me things I didn't remember from that day. She later ran a 5K and a 10K race to raise money for the RNLI. She said, The volunteer crew saved my life that day and I wouldn't be here without them. On Monday, the RNLI revealed the number of times rescue lifeboats were dispatched in Scotland during 2023 was 1,251, an increase of 12% when compared to the previous year. Crews from 46 lifeboat stations saved 15 lives in Scotland in 2023. The RNLI is now asking for supporters to partake in its Mayday Mile fundraiser, an initiative where supporters can travel a mile each day throughout May to raise money for the lifeboat service. Jill Hepburn, Head of Region for RNLI Scotland, says, Summer is our busiest time of year, with thousands of people at risk of getting into danger by the water. Having recently marked the RNLI's 200th anniversary, we are putting out our call for help to raise the funds which will help keep our life-saving service going today and into the future. As a charity, we rely on the support and generosity of the public to take part in events like the Mayday Mile, and raise the funds that allow us to be there when we're needed most. And that report was by Jodie Harrison.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 9th of April, 2024, from the Voices section. Should William Ragg be shamed for his sexuality after Grindr scandal? This article is by Katrina Stewart. You. No sniggering at the back. We are talking about an honourable member's member today, so straight faces and no nonsense, please. It is a serious issue, so do settle down and strap in. No, I said in. As cannot have escaped you, the Tories are mired in yet another scandal. And as with so much present British politics, the scandal is grubby and small and ridiculous. William Ragg, the MP for Hazelgrove in Greater Manchester and chair of the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee, has been caught in what is being very kindly dubbed a honey trap situation. Honey trap implies some level of effort and sophistication and an offer that was simply too good to refuse. In reality, Mr. Ragg fell for a type of con known as spear phishing, when one is targeted online in a fraud that aims to extort information. The 36-year-old was contacted on the dating app Grindr by someone claiming to know him and was asked to provide a compromising picture. Astonishingly, he obliged, sending images on via WhatsApp. When the honey trap turned into a threat to release the photos, Mr. Ragg handed over colleagues' phone numbers. I saw these colleagues described as fellow grandees, which implies Mr. Ragg is a Tory grandee. A grandee? He has been in Parliament since 2015. Like I say, so much of present British politics is small and ridiculous. Of course, he served under 5 prime ministers in that time, but it's hardly a badge of honour. Those colleagues, fellow MPs, a political journalist and Westminster staffers, were then similarly approached and, would you Adam and Eve it, others sent on their own nutty picks. Dismayed, the tabloids have missed the opportunity to call it raggle-rocked. Anyway, as far as sex scandals go, it's not exactly a Keeler-Profumo-Ivanov triangle, is it? A honey trap brings to mind at least a little glamour, not a dick pic on a dating app. It is mere weeks since I wrote about being described on the radio as a sex cave correspondent, following the fallout from Creative Scotland accidentally funding a porn film. Continuing the theme, last week I was in the bizarre position of discussing the relative aesthetic merits of male genitalia alive on the radio with Ruth Davidson, or Baroness Davidson of London Lynx, as she is to her friends. Miss Davidson, while admitting she is not the target audience for such material, asked me whether I thought there was a gendered element to this scandal. Would a female MP have fallen for this? Women are not so prone to sending pics of their nutty bits to strangers. We are conditioned to have a higher sense of risk around such behaviour. Certainly we are far more shamed for any sort of sexual impropriety or any sense of sexual fulfilment at all. But is there a woman in Parliament who would send naked photos to a complete stranger? Highly doubtful. There is, though, a question of shame there that makes this a particularly human scandal and makes me feel, albeit grudgingly, a deal of pity for William Ragg. One government minister I spoke to about the incident has no truck with the situation at all. What's the scandal here? Politician has penis. So what? Incidentally, another politician said to me wistfully, I'd love to be embroiled in a sex scandal, so I'm keeping an eye on them. While the minister's take is a gross oversimplification, there are 2 layers to it. Downing Street is supporting Mr. Ragg for one reason and one reason only. Rishi Sunak cannot afford another by-election. It would make the 24th of this Parliament, assuming there aren't others in the meantime. It's getting to the point we'll hardly need a general election because we'll have done the thing one seat at a time, and actually none of us should really be minded to give an early opportunity for Reform UK to test the waters with its pro-cannibalism candidates. Should Mr. Ragg have the whip removed? For undermining parliamentary standards? For breaching his colleague's security? For acting like a complete and utter idiot? Absolutely yes. For the naked pictures, no. If it was the days of the Profumo scandal, then an apology would have been offered and a sword fallen upon. Another fashion of current political discourse is avoidance of contrition. Instead, we have semi-sorries or total avoidance of responsibility. What stands out here is Ragg's genuine remorse. I've hurt people by being weak, he told the Times. I was scared, I'm mortified, I'm so sorry that my weakness has caused other people hurt. His issue is that the remorse is less for the security breach and more for the humiliation of being hamstrung by his desires. If you are of the mind that a naked photograph of yourself might be career-ending or humiliating, then the only way to proceed is not to share naked photographs with anyone. My aforequoted minister is partially correct. There should be an element of so what to the naked photo part of this. In my role as a court reporter, I often speak to victims of romance frauds who suffer in silence for a long time before coming forward because they feel shame and humiliation that their very natural desires and needs for love, for attention, for sex have been exploited and manipulated. Had we a more open and tolerant, and dare I say it, understanding view of these things, Ragg would not have been open to being blackmailed. He would have done a stupid thing in believing in a fake dating account, but he might not have leaked sensitive data to try and cover up for himself. Excuse the brief pivot, but there is, of course, another element to this, which is the ongoing issue of government by WhatsApp and what to do about it. Use of the messaging platform keeps cropping up in connection with the undermining of democratic conventions. What this all comes down to, ultimately, is competence. RAG is not some elder statesman grappling with modern technology. He is in the millennial age bracket that grew up with technology and shouldn't be bested by very, very simple fraudulent attacks. Truly, it is rock bottom when your MP is prioritising penis over party. That article was by Katrina Stewart.
The Herald Scotland. On Tuesday, the 9th of April, 2024. From the Sport section. PFA chief issues stark warning as missile and pyro incidents rise. This article was written by Matthew Lindsay and is being read by me, Corey. Fraser Wishart, the chief executive of football union PFA Scotland, has voiced his grave concerns about the number of players who have been pelted by missiles in the Scottish game this season, and warned that clubs risk having their stadiums closed if fans continue to cause unrest in the stands. The Cinch Premiership game between Rangers and Celtic at Ibrox on Sunday, a six-goal classic which was broadcast live by Sky Sports, was marred by objects being thrown at Parkhead playmaker Matt O'Reilly on the pitch and assistant manager John Kennedy in the dugout. A glass bottle narrowly missed O'Reilly after he had scored a first-half penalty to put the visitors 2-0 ahead, and Kennedy was also struck by coins as he stood in the technical area. The Scottish champions described the incidents, which are now being investigated by Police Scotland, as totally unacceptable afterwards, and stressed they would be raising their serious concerns with the city rivals. However, they were far from freak occurrences. Hearts and Scotland striker Lawrence Shankland had a bottle opener with a knife at one end hurled at him as he waited to take a penalty during the Edinburgh Derby at Tynecastle back in February. Hibernian striker Emanuelo Marcondes was hit by a missile after opening the scoring in that match. Hibs announced last month they were going to be slashing the ticket allocations they traditionally give Celtic and Rangers at Easter Road due to the abhorrent behaviour and chanting of their opponents' supporters. Their home matches against the Glasgow Giants have been marred by large-scale pyrotechnic displays in the past few seasons. Wishart has been alarmed at the treatment PFA Scotland members have been subject to in recent months, and stressed that hooligans are endangering the players that they are cheering on as well as fans of their own team with their reckless actions. He also stated that Yobs could face legal action as well as criminal charges. "This is obviously highly concerning," he said. "I have always struggled to understand the mentality of someone who throws something at another human being just because they are wearing a different shirt from their team. It is just bizarre. You could go down a rabbit hole trying to understand the mentality of these people. Sadly, there are a number of them at most clubs in Scottish football. The football field is a player's workplace. The person who throws something at a footballer wouldn't accept anybody coming into their workplace and throwing something at them. They have to start looking upon football players as human beings and workers like everybody else. Then we can maybe make some progress. It is what is being thrown at players as well. It could hit somebody in the head, or their face, or in the eye. It could scar them. This, along with other things like sectarian singing, racist chanting, discriminatory songs, and the use of pyrotechnics, supporter behaviour that needs to stop. Fans need to take on board the damage that they could do to individuals, whether it be their fellow supporters or players.
If a player ever gets hit and injured, then he will come to me, and we will get our lawyers on it. At that point, the gloves are off. The individual responsible will not only be facing jail time, there could be litigation as well. Hibs announced they would not be giving Celtic and Rangers fans the entire South Stand in future after a supporter of the Parkhead club had his hair set on fire by a flare which was ignited by one of his fellow fans during a Premiership game in Leith in February. A young Dundee fan was burned on the side of his face by a lit device that was thrown during a league game against St Johnstone at McDermid Park at the end of last month. Wishaw keeps in close contact with players' union representatives in other countries, and he revealed how the increased use of pyrotechnics in the game has resulted in one club in Ireland having their supporters banned from attending two matches and players in Cyprus threatening to go out on strike. There was a game in Ireland this season, and a Bohemians player got a pyro thrown at him, he said. It hit him and burned his arm. Bohemians got prevented from having any supporters at their next couple of games by the IFA, and they accepted it. There was also a bad incident in Cyprus this season. A player got hit by a pyro and it damaged his hearing. I think it is only going to be a short-term problem. I think he is going to be okay. But the players over there are going nuts about it and are demanding better health and safety. There is talk of a player strike over there. People think that folk who are concerned about pyro at football are just old fogies. We're not. These things are very serious. There have been meetings between the governing bodies and the authorities about tackling pyro use this season, but it continues. People think these things are harmless. Throwing a coin at a player, so what? Throwing a pyro from the stand onto the pitch, so what? But these things are dangerous to players and supporters as well. They could hit their own supporters. We saw a kid the other week at the St Johnstone versus Dundee game who got hit by a flare. Celtic closed down the safe standing section of Parkhead for two games in 2017 after the safety advisor group of Glasgow City Council, which issues the certificate the club needs to stage games at their stadium, voiced concerns about flares being lit underneath banners by the ultra element among their support. Wishaw feels that grounds could be closed unless decisive action is taken to stamp out growing disorder in the stands at matches across the country, and protect players and fans. If we are not careful, then the local authorities and the government are going to step in, he said. The governing bodies won't take any action against the clubs, but the government, the police, and the local council will if they're not careful. That is something we don't want to get to. That's the worry, that's the danger. We think football is different. It isn't. We think football players aren't employees. They are. We think that games aren't normal events. They are. They are run by the same rules. We shouldn't dismiss the prospect of local councils looking at this as well. That is my concern. If the fans don't stop throwing objects and pyrotechnics and singing racist and sectarian songs, then somebody somewhere is going to say, why are we putting up with this? We wouldn't put up with this at any other event. That is the real worry for the clubs. Fans need to start behaving. That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the sport section. It was written by Matthew Lindsay, and it was read by me, Corey. The Herald Scotland, on Tuesday, the 9th of April, 2024. From the sport section. Rangers versus Celtic attracts record Sky Sports viewing figures. An article written by Johnny McFarlane, and read by me, Corey. Sunday's electrifying Old Firm Derby, which ended in a 3-3 draw between Rangers and Celtic, set a new TV viewership record for the SPFL. The encounter, pivotal in the race for the clinch Premiership title, saw Sky Sports viewership numbers peak at 1.44 million, surpassing the previous record set in December of 2019 when Rangers triumphed over Celtic with a 2-1 victory at Parkhead. With the Cinch Premiership heading towards an exhilarating conclusion, Celtic currently leads by a slender margin of 1 point, atop the league table, while Rangers, with a game in hand, are hot on their heels. Neil Doncaster, SPFL Group Chief Executive, expressed his elation at the record-breaking viewership figures. "It's fantastic news to see record viewing numbers for Sunday's big match between Rangers and Celtic at Ibrox. These figures demonstrate both the huge interest in this renowned fixture, as well as the increased appeal for our game across Scotland, the UK and beyond. The game itself certainly didn't disappoint and was hugely exciting for all supporters who turned in. It promises to be a really dramatic end to the season, with even more big games to watch live on Sky Sports in the coming weeks. And I know the SPFL will continue to deliver the drama and excitement that our league is renowned for." Gary Hughes, Sky Sports Director of Football, also shared his enthusiasm for the record audience, attributing it to the compelling title race narrative that the Old Firm Derby encapsulated. He said, "It's great to see the excitement of the title race translate into a record audience for us at Sky Sports. It was a dramatic game and underlines the quality of the product on the pitch, which we are committed to continue growing alongside our partners at the SPFL. We're looking forward to bringing fans the closing stages of the season and the final Old Firm game post-split." That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Johnny McFarlane and read by me, Corey.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Tune Review and tell your friends about our service.